covers on the mics now, so as not to disrupt your arguments, and then we'll call the case and get started. And while you're doing that, I will just note that this is our third oral argument of the morning. And the case is State of Minnesota versus Rebecca Ann Jones, case number A21-1337. And just a few remarks before we get started this morning. I know that you're both familiar with our timing rules, but I will remind you that appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before you begin your argument, I just ask that you introduce yourselves and note the party that you are representing. And with that, I think we are ready to go. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Your Honor, good morning. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Max Keller, M-A-X-K-E-L-L-E-R, for appellant Ms. Jones. I haven't seen you all or this courtroom in person for a while, so it's a little bit different. My next argument here is on Zoom. In this case, all the facts are undisputed. The trooper was the only witness at the omnibus hearing. Some of those important undisputed facts are that Ms. Jones was in the front of the parking lot for 30 seconds, not a long period of time. She went in the back of the parking lot, again, for 30 seconds. That's what the trooper said. So a total of 60 seconds. He could see her for the first 30 seconds because she was in the front of the parking lot. So we know she wasn't doing any of these speculative things that he claimed when she was in the front of the parking lot. She certainly wasn't damaging any vehicles or trying to break into the building because he would have seen that. And I guess I would argue that she certainly wasn't doing drugs or any of these other speculative things that he claimed when she was parked in the front of the building, because he would have seen that. Now, the whole 30 seconds that she was in the back, it's basically enough time to turn around. The state says, well, she could have turned around in the front. That may be true, but the trooper testified that it'd be easier to turn around in the back, basically.
Mr. Keller, can I ask you a few questions about the district court's finding? So here the district court found that the trooper credibly testified about the suspicious driving behavior and then characterized that suspicious driving behavior as evasive, not as criminal.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so the question is whether the trooper actually has to use the word "I witnessed evasive driving" in order for it to be evasive driving, or whether the circumstances that were described by the trooper can give rise to a factual finding that there was evasive driving. Can you comment on that?
Sure, thank you. That's a very good question because that is something that we discussed in our brief. So the court's specific question is, does the trooper have to use the word evasive? Well, I suppose not, in that we're not supposed to have magic words in the law, but I don't think what he described is evasive. I think if you're going to go up there and you're a trooper and you're going to testify to why you think you had a reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop someone, you have to somehow phrase it in a way that the other side would be on notice of what the argument is.
I mean, he does say that it was suspicious. And when we're talking about suspicious behavior, I think the trooper was testifying about events that even preceded your client entering the parking lot. For example, he was following her on, I think it was Highway 25, 29? Highway
25.
Following her on Highway 25. It was dark. and then he sees her turn into the lot and stop. He drives past the lot, turns around. She goes around the building where it's dark and then exits the parking lot and goes the same direction that she was traveling. And I'm just wondering why it was clearly erroneous or an abuse of discretion, whatever standard you want to argue, for the district court to draw the inference that the trooper could conclude that that was suspicious, meaning evasive.
Well, your question is kind of assuming or stating something that I don't think is correct. Your question, Your Honor, is saying that suspicious in this case means evasive, and I don't agree with that, and that was part of the point of my brief is suspicious is one thing, evasive is another thing. The evasive cases I discussed, they involve things such as the driver looked at the trooper and then immediately turned off. Or, interestingly enough, that was one Johnson case. In another Johnson case, they said, well, the driver refused to look at the police officer, and that was suspicious.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Keller, because I agree with you that it seems to be flawed for the district court to equate the factual determinations it made with evasive. I mean, I think suspicion is the word that would be more appropriate. But since we review the fact-finding for clear error and the legal conclusion de novo, what difference does it make that the district court, in her legal conclusions, used the word evasive as opposed to suspicious?
Well, the mere using the word doesn't necessarily matter, Your Honor. Thank you for that question. But it's then you logically would advance from using that word, if you're the district court, to saying, well, it was evasive. On our brief on page 15, it cites to the trial court memorandum at pages 2 to 5, and the trial court used the word evasive 4 times and evade 2 times and the word suspicious 3 times, then this is the important part. I agree it doesn't necessarily matter the word, except that you logically then go to discuss, a decision maker is going to discuss cases then citing evasive driving, and this is not evasive driving. Cooper Schmutzer didn't say it was evasive. What he described isn't evasion. The parties weren't arguing about evasion. Then I wrote a brief saying, in part, this is not evasion, and the state filed their brief in this court saying, well, yeah, of course, it's not evasion.
Right, and again, what I'm not sure I understand is what difference does it make? We review the findings of fact for clear error and the legal effect of the findings de novo. So we can all agree this wasn't evasive driving and it wouldn't change the question before us, and that is, does the record support the findings of fact, and do those totality of facts provide reasonable articulable suspicion for the stop, right?
Right, but if the question is, was the trial court correct in its reasoning when it uses the term evasive and then it cites cases to support the proposition that there was a reasonable articulable suspicion to support a traffic stop based on cases that say if a driver is evasive, you can stop the driver. Well, the officer didn't think the driving was evasive.
Let me try to get at this question
the cases are inapplicable.
So, Mr. Keller, I think we all agree that the record shows that your client, after stopping in the front part of the parking lot, went to the back part of the parking lot, right?
That's right, for 30 seconds, Your Honor.
So would it be clearly erroneous to find, for the district court to find, that that conduct going from a well-lit area to an area that wasn't visible behind the building was evasive?
Well, that's not based on a clearly erroneous standard, so I'm afraid that I don't agree with the question. The question is whether in your de novo review of the undisputed facts, whether you agree with the trial court's application of the law. I don't agree that it's a clearly erroneous standard.
So your point is that whether conduct was evasive is a question of law and not one of fact?
I do agree with that, Your Honor, and this is part of what the trial court said here that I cited on page 15 of our brief. Which is at the end of the memorandum. I believe that's page 5, but I said the end of the memorandum. The trial court said, based on the totality of the circumstances, including the time of the night that the business was closed, the dark parking lot, the length of time, which I said in brackets, a mere 60 seconds, the vehicle was in the parking lot without apparent reason, which of course, now this is me speaking now, that's consistent with someone who's lost, someone who's checking their phone, making a phone call, so on. The trial court continues, and the officer's knowledge of crimes occurring in the other empty parking lots in the area, and I had a footnote after the word empty there because this parking lot was not empty. So if that's a factual finding, that's clearly erroneous because everyone knows that the parking lot was not empty. There's testimony that wasn't empty, and no one is really claiming that it was empty. Then the trial court said, crimes occurring in other empty parking lots in the area. Well, we have no idea what the in the area means. It could be the other side of town. Then the trial court said, Trooper Schmutzer reasonably suspected the driver of the vehicle might be engaged in criminal activity. So I think it does matter whether it's evasive or suspicious because there's different cases supporting different types of conduct. Generally speaking, the suspicious driving cases, they have some other element that's not present in this set of facts.
So it's your position that the trooper's testimony that he did have suspicion, thought it could have been the driver's intention to vandalize the building or to remove tires from vehicles because we've had that in the dealership lots here, that reference to other crime in the area just isn't specific enough to support the district court's finding of fact?
In part, yes, Your Honor, because what does that mean, what he said? We all sit here, we could all ask ourselves, what does that mean? Nobody has any idea what that means. When he said, in dealership lots here, what does that mean? Does that mean in Buffalo? They could be on the other side of town. They could be 5 miles on the other side of town. No one asked him what that means. So we don't know in the record what that means.
And does the case law suggest it has to be within a particular geographic distance to the place of the current driving conduct to provide reasonable suspicion to a law enforcement officer?
I would assert, Your Honor, that the case law doesn't say that it does or it doesn't, but does a court want to put its imprimatur onto something where someone can just say, well, we've had some thefts. Where? Well, we're here in Maplewood. We had some thefts in Minneapolis, so therefore there's a reasonable suspicion that because this car was parked in the Caribou parking lot for 30 seconds, I can go and stop this person. Wait a minute. Minneapolis, Maplewood, what are you talking about? I think it has to be specific. Otherwise, I mean, his statement is just meaningless, basically, because no one asked him to follow up.
What about the generalized suspicion of drug use that the officer identified during his testimony?
Well, that's just ridiculous, Your Honor. It's totally speculative. Everything that he said is totally speculative. He said, well, she could be using drugs. She could be vandalizing stuff. Sure. She could be back there building a bomb. She could be calling President Putin. She could be making Molotov cocktails to throw at the Russian invaders. She could be doing lots of things. What's any information, any facts that would tend to make someone believe that that might be happening?
So to put a finer point on it, your position is that a generalized suspicion of some behavior without some explanation as to why that behavior is present or why that suspicion is present in this particular case is insufficient.
There has to be something more than what was here, Your Honor. In suspicious vehicle cases, for example, in Petrick, which was cited by the state below and here too, the police were following a car that turned into the first available driveway and turned off its headlights. You can call that suspicious or evasive, but that's nothing like the facts here. In the trial court, the state cited State versus Hataha. That's driving slowly and maybe impeding other traffic. Here, there's nothing wrong with Ms. Jones driving. Then we come to Tomczyk versus Commissioner, which is a case that was cited by both parties here in the Court of Appeals. It's labeled as a suspicious vehicle case. In that case, the vehicle was parked for an unknown period of time, which I think is significant, in an empty parking lot late at night in an area undergoing construction, which again I think is significant because the Court of Appeals in that case said, well, basically, you have all kinds of construction materials that are out there at a construction site that anyone can walk up to and steal. That made the ongoing construction in the area made it, in the officer's opinion, likely or possible that burglaries or vandalism were going to occur. Now, that's speculative, but at least there was a lot more facts there, and because we're told that the car was parked for an unknown period of time, the car could have been there an hour. That's highly distinguishable from the facts of this case, where we know that the car was there for 30 seconds in the front, 30 seconds in the back, and that's not enough time to do anything, basically. But I see my time has expired.
Thanks, Mr. Keller. You may begin when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Hannah Spencer, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this appeal. As has been stated, this appeal comes before you following a stipulated facts trial. There is no disputed facts in this case, and so the sole legal issue is whether the stop was justified by reasonable, articulable suspicion, considering the time, the location, the appellant's suspicious behavior, and the trooper's personal knowledge and observations. Now, there was quite a bit of conversation about the trial court's order and the evasive driving cases. I'm happy to discuss that further, but I think it would be most beneficial to step back and look at the binding precedent that controls the reasonable articulable suspicion standard, as well as the facts from this case specifically applied to that standard, which will go back to your point, Your Honor, that the de novo review does not bear down on the trial court's order, so a lot of that discussion becomes a moot point. Looking first at the precedent, tracing all the way back to the seminal case of Terry versus Ohio, as I'm sure Your Honors have heard many a time before, an officer conducting a warrantless investigatory seizure must be able to point to specific and articulable facts which, taken together with rational inferences from those facts, reasonably warrants the intrusion. Reasonable articulable suspicion means that an officer must be able to testify at the omnibus hearing to a particularized and objective basis for suspecting the appellant of criminal activity.
So in this case, and to Mr. Keller's point, the officer identified a litany of possibilities. It's possible that she was stealing tires. It's possible that there was some there could be some vandalism. It's possible that there could be drug use. I mean, and it could be possible that any host of things were occurring. Doesn't there have to be some additional testimony that those possibilities manifested themselves in this particular case, or that there was some reason for him to believe that those possibilities were manifesting themselves in this case?
So two parts to your question, Your Honor. Does there have to be a manifestation that those things occurred? No. The court has stated in State versus Martinson that innocent activity could justify criminal activity. Right. So it doesn't have to have actually happened. Those suspicions do have to be reasonable. They have to be reasonable inferences from the facts. Now, what the officer in testimony said was not, it's possible that these things were occurring. He specifically said what he observed and what he suspected. So he stated at the omnibus hearing that he observed the appellant's vehicle pull into the lot of a closed business called Functional Industries at 11 o'clock at night. He had been driving behind appellant's vehicle down Highway 25, so he didn't know where she was coming from, but he noted that he found this behavior suspicious because he knew that the business was closed, the parking lot was not very well lit, there was other better lit lots nearby, and yet she pulled into this parking lot, stopped in the front of the building for approximately 30 seconds, during which time she wasn't parked in a parking spot, which would suggest maybe that she had a more legitimate reason for being there. So he testified to those facts and the suspicions that they raised. He also noted that he considered that maybe she was cleaning staff or there for some other reason, so he stopped and he observed her further. After she was in the front of the lot for 30 seconds, she then proceeded farther into the back of the lot, which is an area between the two buildings. It was out of the trooper's line of sight, and it was darker than that front area of the lot. He testified that that raised his suspicions further for a number of reasons. First, he knew that Functional Industries housed buses used to transport its clientele in the back area of the lot, and so he became suspicious that vandalism of the buildings or the buses may occur. He also testified that he was aware of theft of tires happening at nearby dealership lots. He was concerned with the knowledge of the buses in the back that theft of the buses' tires might occur.
Ms. Spencer, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Wouldn't all of those suspicions be dispelled by virtue of the timing? 30 seconds in the front of the lot where she was observed, 30 seconds in the back of the lot where she wasn't observed. I mean, would these be reasonable suspicions by the officer given that time?
They are reasonable that he held them, Your Honor. There's nothing curative in the case law to say that, well, they were immediately dispelled because 30 seconds later she emerged. He did testify that he felt that the time that she was back there was longer than would be consistent with someone turning around. So it still have remained the suspicion that something may have happened. And then going back to the point that no crime had to actually occur, she could have been planning to do a crime and then changed her mind. Maybe she did know the trooper was there, but we don't have those facts on the record. To go a little further and, the trooper had testified to his suspicions that drug use could be occurring. So I'll share with the court, as an addict in recovery from long-term recovery from addiction, someone using illegal drugs could do so very quickly. So the fact that she was there for a short period of time wouldn't necessarily dispel the trooper's suspicions because all they had to be was reasonable.
I would like to talk a little bit about the inferences. I mean, this is kind of fundamental, I guess, right? Terry talks about the reasonable inferences that can be made from the facts. Whose inferences? The officer's inferences or the court that's considering the motion to suppress? I mean, here we have two different sets of inferences that were made, by the officer about what might have been happening, and it looks like a different one by the court looking at those facts. So whose inferences are the appropriate inferences for this court to be focusing on from the facts?
So, Your Honor, it's the officer's inferences from what he was observing, and those inferences must be reasonable. There's kind of a split in the question here, and there was this discussion about the trial court and the evasive driving. The trial court, towards the end of their order, did correctly support those inferences. They stated the facts and the factors, those inferences that came from it, the time, the location, late at night, appellant's suspicious behavior in the way that she was in the front of the lot and then the back of the lot, and how that supported the trooper's inferences of reasonable, articulable suspicion. Looking at then Applegate versus Commissioner of Public Safety, the reasonable, articulable suspicion can be formed from the officer's general knowledge and experience, the information an officer has received from other sources, the nature of the offenses suspected, the time, the location, and anything else that is relevant. So essentially the totality of circumstances, and that's at the end of its order what the trial court rested on was the totality of circumstances supporting that inference of reasonable articulable suspicion.
So general suspicion.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure what you mean by general
suspicion. I think what we're all maybe struggling here with with some of our questions is the fact that the officer testified to some specific suspicions about what was happening back there. The district court, found that the driving conduct was evasive, which is sort of a different flavor of suspicion. And the question is that a problem that the officer reached a different conclusion maybe than the officer did as to what the factual circumstances might be inferring, or what could be inferred from those factual circumstances?
I understand, Your Honor. So the overarching threshold here is reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity. The officer was specific in his testimony to certain crimes he thought might be occurring: theft, vandalism, illegal drug use. The trial court took a bit of a foray into this evasive driving cases, but as has been noted, that de novo review makes that foray not determinative to this court's review, but the trial court did ultimately reach the correct conclusion based on the totality of the circumstances. And so a lot of that conversation about the evasive driving can just be set aside. The fact that the trial court cited to Petrick or Johnson can just be set aside because it's de novo review. But when you look at the facts, the trooper's testimony specific to those facts, to what he suspected, all of that meets the threshold requirement of reasonable, articulable suspicion, which our court has stated is not high. It simply needs to not be based on mere whim, caprice, or idle curiosity, which the testimony in this case shows that it wasn't.
Spencer, let me ask you this. How do you respond to Mr. Keller's argument that the trooper's references to, you know, we've had removing tires, we've had that in the dealership lots here, is just too vague to provide any sort of reasonable suspicion of criminal act that Ms. Jones was going to engage in criminal activity at this particular business at 11 p.m. that night?
Your Honor, I think for the court to put weight into that interpretation of the trooper's statement would pull the court outside of the precedent as far as cases of this factual nature.
So you think the Tomachek line of cases applies even when you don't have specific reference to a geographic area or even a city?
Well, certainly, Your Honor. In Tomachek, or Tomchak, I'm sorry. I've practiced saying Tomachek, so I may be saying it wrong.
I don't know.
That's how
you're
I know how
right.
to say it.
You're probably right.
But in that case, the facts of the case, at least as they appeared in the Court of Appeals opinion, don't say how close geographically that the driver was. They say that it was in an empty lot near an area undergoing construction. But the court has never put in that requirement within 100 feet of the area undergoing construction. I think the natural language that the trooper used, we've had that in dealership lots here. It's clear to just the average interpreter of that language that he meant somewhere nearby. And ultimately, not just that he meant it nearby, but that he had that knowledge that there was the possibility of thefts in the area based on knowledge that he had of other incidents. That's ultimately what the reasonable, articulable suspicion standard is turning on. So turning back then to Temexec and Olmsheed, I want to draw the court's attention to those two cases in particular. There is an expansive body of case law on reasonable, articulable suspicion, but those two cases are the most factually similar to this case. And we've talked about Temexec a bit here, but the facts being the officer observed a vehicle late at night in an empty parking lot near an area undergoing construction, and he testified specifically that he was concerned vandalism, theft, or burglary may occur. In Temexec, as well as in this case, no theft or vandalism was found to have occurred, but the subsequent stop resulted in a DWI arrest. And in Temexec, this court upheld the reasonable articulable suspicion based upon the time and the location near an area susceptible to particular crimes. In this case, we have time late at night and a location susceptible to particular crimes. You have a closed business lot in down Highway 25 is more of a commercial area, so it wasn't residential. So those facts match up between Temexec and the present case. And then looking at Olmsheed, which is also a very factually similar case to this present case. In Olmsheed, the officer observed a vehicle in the early morning hours on a dead-end road near a commercial district when he was aware of other crimes, theft occurring in the area. In Olmsted, no theft had occurred, and the officer had not reported any crime, or had not received any reports of crimes that evening, which is similar to the present case. But the subsequent stop resulted in a DWI arrest, and again, this court upheld the finding of reasonable articulable suspicion based upon the time, the location, and the officer's personal knowledge of thefts in the area. And here again, in this case, we have the same thing: time, location, the officer's personal knowledge.
Did either of those cases involve situations where the suspicious driver actually left the area, as we have in this case with the departure from the parking lot after 60 seconds?
I think left the area is getting a bit vague looking at the facts of this case. In Temecsic, the stop was made near that area.
Well, I think, in fact, the officer saw the vehicle in that parking lot with its lights on and approached the driver right there. So there was never an opportunity for the suspicion to be dispelled by subsequent conduct of the driver, correct?
Right. And then in Olmsted, the driver's driving down a dead-end road, and the stop was made before the vehicle reach wherever it was going, I suppose. And so there wasn't really a chance in that case either for the appellant to leave the area, whereas in this case, the officer made the stop right after she was leaving that parking lot. And so it's not like the officer then came about appellant's vehicle 15 minutes later and stopped her and said he still had a reasonable articulable suspicion based on her previous behavior, but his stop was proportionate and reasonable to the time of when he observed those things occur. So he saw them and he stopped her immediately afterwards. The fact that she had returned to the roadway wouldn't be determinative to that analysis because the suspicions that he had, particularly, for example, illicit drug use, could have already occurred, or it could be something that would continue to occur. Maybe she was casing the building. Maybe she got spooked and was planning to return later. Ultimately, those things aren't tied into the minimal threshold required for reasonable articulable suspicion.
All right, Ms. Spencer, your time is actually up, and if you have any final comments you want to make, or you can just be done.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just ask this court to affirm the trial court's ultimate conclusion that the stop was justified by reasonable articulable suspicion, and I thank you all for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Keller.
Thank you, Your Honor. Basically, the only basis of suspicion in this case is three things: 30 seconds in the front, 30 seconds in the back. The front isn't that well lit, but it's better lit than the back, and there's a closed business there. Now, as I said in our brief, he could have recorded her license plate number because he obviously was in a position to do that. 30 seconds really is not enough to do anything. But if you think like, well, maybe it could have been anything. He could have written down her license plate number, let her momentarily drive by, go about her business. He could drive in the back of the lot, see if there's a fire going on there. Of course, there was no fire. Then he'd say, okay, well, she was just lost or whatever. All right, there's no reason to stop her. Now, the state says, well, it could have been illicit drug use. Oh, sure, it could have been a million things, but let's go with that. Okay, so if the police are behind you, and the police are going to argue that you know they're behind you, it's dark, you may not know that, but assuming that you know that, you could turn left after properly signaling your left-hand turn onto another road, and you could actually be using drugs while you're driving. So therefore then, according to the state's theories then, anytime the police are behind someone and they turn left then, well, that's evasive because, you know, they turn left. Why don't they just keep on going the same direction that the officer's going, which they don't know that anyways, but, you know, whatever. And then obviously they turn left because they're evasive and they're suspicious. Obviously they're using drugs because it only takes a moment to use drugs. So obviously there's a reasonable suspicion. So you can pull over anyone who turns left when they're in front of the police. I mean, I think that's the conclusion here. The state argues that, well, the officer must have meant when he said there was some thefts from dealerships here, the officer must have meant that it's nearby. Well, that's really interesting. That's certainly not in the record. Now, here's another way of looking at it. If it really happened right down the street or across the street from Functional Industries, surely the officer would have said that because the officer wants to support his stop. So wouldn't we actually assume the opposite? If it happened nearby, the officer would have said that. The officer didn't say that. Therefore, we could reasonably assume it did not happen nearby. As I said before, all the other cases basically have some added facts, some other indicia. This is a so bare, basically. I just learned that Ms. Jones, I was not the trial counsel in this criminal case, and I wasn't the trial counsel in her implied consent case, but she filed an implied consent petition, and she had an implied consent hearing, and I just learned that a different judge found that the stop was not supported by reasonable suspicion in the implied consent case, and I think you can take that as a supplemental authority, and the trial court judge in the implied consent case quite simply said that it's not reasonable to believe that there was criminal activity afoot or that there was a reasonable articulable suspicion because, as I said, the car was in the front for 30 seconds, the car was in the back for 30 seconds. It's just not enough time to do anything, so it's not reasonable. And if you think that is reasonable, then I suggest the police can pretty much stop anybody anytime they want for any reason, because all you have to do is to go up there and say, well, I had a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. Well, what was it? Well, look, here's a statute book. There's 5 million laws here. Let's just start listing off any or all of the 5 million laws that are in the statute book. Okay, well, he said he had a reasonable articulable suspicion, and when we know that officers are so smart, they're trained in everything, and they're so smart, they know all these things that average people don't know. So if he said he had a reasonable articulable suspicion, it must be true, and he named off some crimes, so it must be enough. So we'd ask that you reverse the trial court and therefore reverse the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to us. And that ends the oral argument portion of our calendar this morning as well.